Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, the Stack Waddy game, okay, and my category this week is Power Pop. You remember Power Pop?
Well, I do. That's interesting, because there were lots of different times that it was meant to be a Power Pop kind of boom, wasn't there? But I go and try me. I think I know what the main moment was.
Yeah, it's kind of post-punk, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, it's Blondie and so forth. Like, it's loads of groups with narrow ties.
It's narrow ties.
Possibly with piano keys on.
It's a very tight trousers, slightly pointy shoes. And I think I can see a linen jacket with the sleeves shunted up.
In the manner
that people like Mike Reed used to wear.
Yes.
Do you remember there was...
Indeed. Indeed. Or Mike Smith, actually.
Smith.
Andy Peebles. Actually,
they're all
Radio 1 DJs who wanted to be slightly hip. They would have done that. Three names of power pop groups, okay, or combos as they might have been called. One of them is invented, okay.
Right.
Here they are: Dirty Looks, The Vinyls, Velvet Crush. Dirty Looks, The Vinyls, and Velvet Crush.
Ooh.
Which one?
Well, The Vinyls. I'll start with The Vinyls. I'm fairly sure The Vinyls existed. I may be wrong, but they seem familiar to me. Velvet Crush. That also seems familiar. But then again, there was a movie, wasn't there? About a band, but they were a kind of underground rock band. I'm actually going to go for Dirty Looks, because am I wrong?
You're wrong.
Oh, you're wrong.
Because I win there.
You win.
Because there was no group called The Vinyls. There is now kind of cover groups that call The Vinyls, but not in the power pop era at all, you know. So it's one of those names that you kind of think inevitably some band must have been called that. They weren't. So I win there.
You win. Okay, well, look, what I have chosen, okay, and I want you to imagine slides of sunsets being crudely projected onto bed sheets, clunky flashing light systems, pale skinny beatniks and proto hippies bathed in dry ice. And I give you three options here. These are bands that played the UFO club.
Oh, okay. So
we're talking two of them are real.
1967, 1968.
Two of them are real and one of them is fake.
Right.
Okay. You've got to spot the ringer here. Okay. Cirrostratus is my first one. Cirrostratus. The second one is The Purple Gang. And the third one is Dead Sea Fruit. Okay, UFO Club, 1967. Two of those groups did play. One of them is made up by me.
Okay, well, The Purple Gang certainly existed. I know that. So I'm assuming that they did play there.
They did. They supported a band called Tomorrow on April the 28th, 1967.
Okay. Dead Sea Fruit. All right, they're real. So the ringer is Cirrostratus.
Oh, had you heard of Dead Sea Fruit?
No, I hadn't. That was just a complete shot in the dark. They were real.
Unbelievably annoying. No, Dead Sea Fruit are real. Yeah, they supported Tomorrow and The Knack on the 30th of June. And it says here they combined the deadpan wit of the Bonzo Dog Band and the social conscious lyricism of the Kinks.
You're
right. No, I made up Cirrostratus, which I thought was absolutely cosmic. This is, of course, a cloud formation.
Shall I tell you about all that I know about clouds, which is not much at all?
Go on.
Not that far from, you know, I'm in North London. As I'm not that far from where I am in Bruce Grove in Tottenham, is my favourite blue plaque in the whole of London. And it's on a very old building, which keeps looking as if it's in, in danger of being demolished. But anyway, when you go down there, you see this blue plaque that says, in this house lived Luke Howard. Quite a cool name, Luke Howard. Namer of clouds. And he's the man, he was a kind of 18th century gentleman, vicar, polymath, who lived there, and he's the man who named, you know, cumulus, cumulonimbus, all those different, you know,
cirrostratus.
What are there, seven? I think there are seven or something like that. Seven different sorts of clouds. So I'm saying, if you're going to have a blue plaque for one thing, that is the coolest thing you can
that
possibly.
That really genuinely is the
Isn't
coolest
it?
Thing.
Isn't it?
We've only got Tommy Cooper in Barrowgate Road. So you win. Well, I'm quite chuffed to live near where Tommy Cooper was.
Have you got, is that Tommy Cooper? Is that a blue plaque or is that a Dead Comic Society kind of
thing? Oh, right. That is blue plaque. Blue plaque.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well, that's very good. It's good to know.
Not bad.
So, okay, that's the stack body game. What else we got to talk about?
Pop news. I was going to mention
hot news. Can I make ticker tape sound in the background?
That's right. No, it's just interesting about the fact that Cat Stevens had re-recorded Tea for the Tillerman. Did you see that?
I did.
That's a re-recording. Yeah, it's 50th anniversary. It's a re-recording. It's not one of those total reinterpretations. People have done that in the past. The Shins, I think, did a completely new version of one of the records they had out. No, this is Cat Stevens just simply to mark the fact that it's 50 years old, putting out a new version of that record. He's done it with Paul Samuel Smith, who is the original producer. The Yardbirds. He's producing it, and the original guitar player, Alan Davis. And it's really good. It's just kind of older, and it's wiser. And I thought it was quite... I can't think of anybody ever doing that. I can think of people of doing re-recordings for commercial reasons. There were lots of those, weren't there? Do you remember
Loads
Squeeze did that album?
Loads.
Which was a note-for-note replica of all the various hits, which I presume is to get your copyright version used.
It's because you don't do that well out of somebody using the original version, whereas if you produce a new one, you can, you know, renew the copyright or something like that. And of course, loads of these people have done it for advertising reasons. Donovan, whose music certainly 10 years ago you heard an awful lot on television commercials, particularly for kind of, I don't know, you know, for kind of high tech, for cars and for phones and so forth, for mobiles.
There's an irony, isn't it? Donovan's songs being used to advertise cars.
They always are. They're done because they make you think it's innocent. You know, the sound of Donovan is kind of woody and pastoral and innocent. Therefore, you can attach it to your gas
tinkling the
car or whatever.
That's right. No, this is a man who's your visual image of him is in a kind of gypsy caravan towed by a horse.
Very shrewdly, he re-recorded all his big hits, you know, and there are many of them, you know, Mellow Yellow and There Is a Mountain and Sunshine Superman and, you know, quite a lot of hit records that are still very familiar to people. And he re-recorded them because basically, if you wanted the right to use the song, which he controlled, he would insist that you use that version, which he also controlled, rather than have Pi Records or their successors, you know, continuing to make money out of it. So fair enough, you know.
So there's no way you could use the original version if that's the one you wanted.
Well, if he was the person who controlled whether you used the song, he could tell you what version to use. And so,
which
Katrina and the Waves
drives the Spotify user completely mad because you must be trying to find the original version of a song which you want to get this.
That's certainly one of the things that sometimes happens. But Katrina and the Waves did this, didn't they? Because Walking on Sunshine was such a big deal as a music in films and commercials and so forth that they went back in the studio and painstakingly recorded it. And it was apparently agony. Somebody in the band was telling me it was agony to do. It took them years because they had to make themselves sound like their kind of 25-year-old selves. You know, they did this in the 40s or 50s, purely in order to be able to control the recording in the same way that they controlled the song. So if you wanted to use Walking on Sunshine, here's the version you use. which to the untutored ear would sound entirely the same, you know, because they're very cleverly done. But it's interesting, the different shades of this, because you talk about Cat Stevens and the attractions of an older voice. Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. Joni Mitchell did a record not that long ago called Travelogue. I don't know if you
remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Where she did kind
covers of all old songs.
Orchestral versions of old songs. And there's some bits of it where you just thought, you shouldn't have done this at all. What's the song where she sings California in that very distinctive way? It's off Blue, I think. I can't remember. Is this flight tonight? I can't remember. River. I don't know. She was California.
I think it's called California. I'm sure. Are they
okay?
I can't remember. Yeah.
Hey, better whatever. And she did it, and she just voice clearly just couldn't hit the same notes that it once hit. You know.
Is it a case of you? Maybe it is.
It might have been. Yeah, I think it might have been a case of you or whatever. But it particularly struck you on that word. You know, it's a really dangerous, dicey thing for artists to do because, you know, we've talked about this loads of times. You know, what they're doing is that they're interfering with your affair with the record that you've known for all these years. They've got a different relationship with it, you know, whereas you don't want to hear any version other than the one you've always heard. You know, nobody thinks, I think they could really improve Waterloo Sunset if they did it again tomorrow.
That's the big issue with Dylan, though, isn't it? In principle, I love Dylan's idea. Dylan's idea is the song, the version that I just happened to play at that moment is the version that gets put out. But the song is a living thing. And every time I play it differently. Because we don't feel like that.
No.
So when Bob Dylan gets up and plays a song, you want to play it like the version you heard in 1967.
Well, because he may be devoted to the song. We're devoted to the record.
Yeah.
Different thing.
Completely different thing.
Very, very different thing. So,
but a lot of it's to do with anniversaries, isn't it? I mean, it's like, who were we interviewing the other day? Thomas Walsh.
It was Matt from Dodgy who was talking about anniversaries, wasn't he? He said that if Dodgy announced, you know, they play from time to time, or they play quite regularly. But he says, if we announce a load of dates that are just we're doing some dates, and we got a record out, people go, yeah, all right, okay. Whereas if you say, it's the 30th anniversary of whatever it was, you know, people start to look in the diary and think, we better not leave this occasion unmarked. We ought to be there, kind of thing.
That's a journalistic thing, isn't it? I mean, that's the way journalism works. You just sit and think, how can we? We've got to have a hook. We've got to have a reason to write about this. You know, if you look at something like the moon landing, it's a classic example. And it's 49th year, and it's 51st year. It's sort of invisible, isn't it? But for that brief moment on its 50th anniversary, absolutely blazing story all over the world. Yeah, no. Because once you're told that a band is touring a certain record, you think, well, where was I when that record came out? What effect did that record have on me? Was it part of the soundtrack of my life?
Yeah,
it makes you kind of focus on your relationship with that record. Kraftwerk did an amazing tour in 2013 where they did, I think they did 8 albums, and they had a greatest hits package, and in between that they would drop in a complete version of one of these different albums, a different one every night. Brilliant idea.
So totally. Talking about anniversaries, I just discovered today, it's 50 years ago this week.
Mike Nesmith,
it's Michael Nesmith's Magnetic South. Michael Nesmith and the First National Band. I think that might have been the first of a number of, these are all really wonderful records. They all kind of look like this, you know, they all had that kind of, you know, semi kind of official US logo on the cover. You know, there's Magnetic South and there's Nevada Fighter and there's another one, Tantamount to Treason and so forth. And they're all really good. They have two things in common. One, they're all really good. And two, you could not give them away. You absolutely could not give them away. Nobody wanted
them. Popular. We had a record in our place at college called Pretty Much Your Average Ranch Stash. Remember
great
that
record.
Came out in 1973. That's a really good record, the one with him winking on the cover.
Really
and
good record.
That was fantastic. And also, you know, he was partly responsible for inventing what I suppose we call country rock to some extent, wasn't he?
Well, I think now they call it, forgive me, alt country.
Alt country.
I hate that expression.
Alt country. What a brilliant life, Mike Nesmith. I mean, admittedly, he had some independent wealth, didn't he, with the old Tipex connection.
But you see, his mother invented liquid correction paper.
That's right.
Yeah, and don't forget, there was a time when the invention of liquid correction paper was a major technological revolution, wasn't it? You know, here's a thing that you can paint over your mistakes.
White paint.
And retype.
And when it's dry, you can type on that. It does seem absolutely unbelievable.
We used to say, back in the days of the Smash Hits office, I've got to try and demonstrate this with a piece of paper now.
I know what you're going to say. My copy had so many corrections on it, it would rock.
It rocked on the deck. Mark Ellen, we used to buy Tipex by the bucket back in the day because Mark used to...
had a kind of Artex so roller had gone up it. That's right.
Just absolutely ridiculous.
I know.
So we're talking about bands that didn't get their just desserts. Last night on Danny Baker's advisement, I watched... there's a film on... it's on Amazon called Feats First, which is... rather unlovely name for a film, about 90 minutes, I suppose, it might even be longer, about Lowell George of Little Feet. And it's kind of a very good, straight film. Barney Hoskins, you know, is in it as a kind of commentator. Van Dyke Parks, the great Van Dyke Parks, who was a mate of Lowell George and worked with him a lot, is in it. And George Massenberg have produced and engineered a lot of their later records. And Russ Titelman, who produced their early records. And it just, in a very workmanlike way, it tells the story of Lowell George. You know, bearing in mind the fact that in those days, you didn't leave behind you anything like the traces that people leave behind them now. You know, there isn't that much film of Little Feet. There is some, you know, them on Whistle Test, them on a German TV show called Rock Palace, them on an American thing as well. There's not an awful lot to go on, whereas nowadays absolutely everything is captured. And it's got some really interesting features in there. It's got a wonderful clip, which I will try and put under this podcast, of Lowell George in a hotel room, probably either in Germany or Holland, I think, demonstrating a slide guitar to an enthralled local journalist. And he is, you know, people used to think he was the coolest man in the world, you know, for that brief window. And he was watching...
Despite the fact he was wearing denim dungarees.
He was wearing denim dungarees. I was talking to Danny last night about you know, there's a good story to be written about the strange fashion sense of Lowell George, you know, because he's the only rock star I've ever seen who took the stage wearing a pullover tied round him, rather like Peter Alice, the golf commentator, might do. You know what I mean? He had those very kind of odd, little habits.
White clogs, do you remember?
White clogs.
He wore white clogs. Oh, I'm sorry, Dave, he did.
I had white clogs. I have no. Okay. And I probably had them because of Lowell George. But anyway, in this sequence where he's playing and singing, he doesn't take the cigarette out of his mouth at any stage. And he sings really, really well while keeping a cigarette.
With a cigarette in the corner of his mouth.
Absolutely in the corner of his mouth. He sings and plays. He's absolutely remarkable. But the funny thing is that the kind of the subtext of a film of this film, like so many films about rock legends, is what a terrible shame it is that they were never more popular. You know what I mean? They were never the great public never really took to them in a big way. And I was thinking to myself, this gets overstated, you know, because I can remember the days with Little Feet, and they were never huge, but they were kind of, they were as big as you can get by being underrated. You know what I mean? And very often the groups we say are underrated are the ones who will never really be popular, because there's something about them that's just too slightly awkward. And that's why we like them. We like them because they'll never be popular. That's why we didn't like the Doobie Brothers, because they were popular.
Yeah, precisely.
Like Little Feet, because they were there at all. And the subject that's constantly returned to in these interviews is, well, if only the record company had got behind, or if only they'd done this. And you think, what are the record company really supposed to do to make any difference in the life of Little Feat? They did what they wanted to do.
They did precisely what they wanted to do. I remember seeing them in 1977, one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life, actually. They were phenomenal. It was around the time it would have been Time Lost a Hero, probably, I think, you know, Red Streamliner, Day at the Dog Races. But I can remember thinking, there's a very finite number of people who are ever going to like this. If you put on Little Feat at a party at the time, it's not like the entire room would go, what's yes. this? Oh, now we've started. All right. Okay. Open another keg, somebody, quickly. My life has begun. You know, they wouldn't. They'd go, I mean, a lot of people would just think this is just, it's complicated and it's, there's no way into it. And
No. So, you know, and also the other thing that struck me was, isn't it wonderful that 40 years later, or however many years it is, still some people are talking about them and still somebody's making a film about them? They're not making a film about them to make a fortune. They won't do, you know, they wanted to make a film about them. You know, so Little Feat, you know, and bands, they're never forgotten, are they? You know what I mean? They may look back and think, oh, I should have been at number one rather than Cat Stevens or whatever. But they're not forgotten. And that's not nothing, is it? You know what I mean? It's the same kind of fame, same kind of reputation in the world of literature, isn't it? You know, there's loads of books that people still talk about now and teach university courses on and, you know, are very treasured. They weren't bestsellers.
I was going to say, they're never the popular ones, though, are they?
No.
Yeah, and had Little Feat kept going and had they had massive hits, I mean, would people still be, would they be making documentaries about them now? I don't know.
I don't think so. No, they would have fallen out in, you know.
They would have fallen out
in the most terrible manner.
And Bill Payne, key player in that group, wasn't he?
Well, it's interesting that Russ Teitelman, I was really pleased to see him interviewed. I've never seen him interviewed before. He produced loads of really good records. And he says that Lloyd George was the kind of genius of the group, but Bill Payne was the key. And I think what he meant was that without Bill Payne, they couldn't lock it together anyway. You know, he could kind of make all those disparate bits, you know, mesh in some way. And I thought that was a really interesting point, really good. But it's there's also a fantastic George Massenberg, who, as I say, was a mate to Lowell George and produced lots of his late records. It's a classic case of when a band comes to Britain, or like a British band went to the States, the slightest bit of success is massively amplified and distorted by the time news of it reaches home. So as far as George Massenberg is concerned, because he wasn't with them when they came to London in 1975 or whenever it was, as far as he was concerned, they blew the Doobie Brothers off the stage at Wembley. You think, no, not Wembley, the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, quite a big difference, you know. But obviously, and he also says at one point, whereas in Britain, Dixie Chicken, it went wild. No,
it didn't.
You know, I was there. It did. A few people liked it, no doubt about it. It did not go wild. But obviously, you know, Chinese whispers, that's how those things work. You know, by the time they get back to America, it's all, oh, they've really broken Britain wide open. Why can't we do the same thing over here? It doesn't work like that, does it at all?
You're listening to The Word Podcast. It's a lockdown lock-in.
If you're watching this as well as listening to it, that probably means you're one of our supporters on Patreon, in which case, very much welcome to the family. And we're expanding the number of products that are offered. Products can be told of that. It's stuff that's offered to people who are Patreon supporters. We're very soon launching our podcast Gold, because we've actually found a cache of completely untouched, complete unedited early podcasts, or right throughout the entire history of the podcast, which, as you'll probably know, is long. And so we're actually representing some of those with a little bit of introduction from us, giving a bit of context. What else can you do? You can also take part in the Word special quiz, which is Friday evenings at 6 o'clock. Make a date and sign up for that. We'll send you a Zoom link so you can take part in that quiz live with us. And also you can have the enormous, incalculable benefit of looking into the attics of myself and Mark Ellen as we actually podcast to you. And so I think, Mark, you're going to list the people who've been added to the roll of honour in the last week, and you've been asked to do it in a very particular fashion.
Yeah, this is Mark Bennett, who's written a very funny letter too, which I might read out actually. But Mark Bennett suggests I do it in appeal voice for the new patrons. So I might as well do it. So, the new patrons are as follows. If I'm any judge, there's Tony Flattery. And unless I'm entirely mistaken, there's Abigail Kinsella and your friend and mine, Mark Bennett.
And two more from him after the news.
Two more from him after the news, as if by magic, Mike Shuttleworth and the irreplaceable Tyler Adams and the irrefutable Matt Verrill and the unimpeachable Ian McLeod and a minor deity, Andy Swain. He speaks for all of us, Jason Rowe, the truly magnificent Jeff Bailey, ploughing his courageous furrow, Mark Holland, the highly collectible John Collins, bravely defined Chris Burton, in a sense, and in a manner of speaking, Mark Parker.
In a sense.
And on 45, when she should have been at 33, Katie Carey had to offer Adrian Ainsworth the one and only one-man army that is Charles Cross and the utterly inimitable Mark McDonald. Oh, and the sensational Andrew Stocks. Andrew Stocks. But that's right. Mark Bennett wrote a nice letter. He said, hello, David Mark. He said, I've been listening to your chat with John Wilson and his comment about going on record with the question, so what is it about spaceships to Bowie, which made me laugh? Remind me of the Enemy interview that Danny Baker did with Earth, Wind and Fire. He teased us for a while with a longish preamble and then delivered his first question. So, Morris, how come you take so much cocaine and live to tell the tale? He also once reported that about a Michael Jackson press conference, which the Prince of Pop had a visible pimple. I think Danny wrote something like, everyone tried to ignore it, but I hung my hat on it. He once told the public image guys that he liked their disco number, Fooder Stomp, and that they didn't cut up rough, but were kind enough to be proud of it. A collection of journo faux pas or provocations would make quite a good segment, I think. Can I think of any? I can think of one classic.
Go on.
And we'll have to mention my name, Dave, Annie Nightingale. Name and shame. Annie Nightingale interviewing Paul Simon. Do you remember that?
On many TV? Years ago. In the 70s.
In the 70s. She said to him, how's it going with the songwriting now that Art Garfunkel's left? And there was that terrible, there was tumbleweed, wasn't
there? Well, no, Paul Simon said, no, I can't think of anything more likely to make Paul Simon bristle. And his man that bristles at the drop of a hat. Because he wrote all those songs himself, and in those days they didn't reshoot a thing like that, which they would do nowadays. If anybody, if you ask a wrong question nowadays, they just do it again.
Well, it's probably live.
No, it wasn't. No, it was on film. It was on film. He just left it in there.
They left it in there.
I can remember it clearly. We were talking about the. You were talking to John Wilson about interviewing David Bowie, and the only time that it was difficult to interview David Bowie was during Tin Machine, because of course they had to be presented as a group. Of course, the only reason anybody's interested in going to see them is because they're not a group.
Oh yeah, the PRs were saying don't concentrate too much on David Bowie.
And there is the story of somebody who went in, so the journalist who decided to get around this problem by walking into the room and going, first question, okay, who's the singer? Which is a really clever idea.
A really good way of getting his attention. That's great.
Absolutely, Bob.
Fantastic.
So, you were talking about, you dropped me a line about Led Zeppelin's Houses of the Holy.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been talking about one of those video cards, hadn't we, about the girl on the cover of the Trees album.
Oh, right.
And you said that the girl on the cover of the Trees album was she related to a member of the Shadows?
Was the daughter of Tony Meehan, who was the drummer of the Shadows in the glory days. And subsequently an A&R man, very well-known person around there.
Well, on that particular tip, that's right, I just started to, I don't know why I was looking up out of idle curiosity, the Houses of the Holy album cover. Did you know that little boy in that, which an amazing cover, isn't it? I mean, Giant's Causeway in Ireland. And it's astonishing to think it took 10 days to get that picture. They were out there for 10 days
The weather was so terrible.
The weather was so appalling. Just think, that is the analogue world summed up, isn't it? The idea you would go out to Ireland for 10 days with your child models who are going to be on there waiting for the right light. But anyway, no, it's something that the small boy is the BBC TV food presenter and writer Stephen Gates.
Yep.
Isn't that interesting? Yep. Well, it makes you think, all these people who are all these anonymous people on these album sleeves. You wonder what.
Well, I've got a few here.
Go on.
We talked about this, haven't we? We planned this. Let's not pretend it's spontaneous. Yeah. So I've got here, of course, there are a few classics here. Bob Dylan, Bringing It All Back Home. Who's that woman with him in the living room? Go on.
That is Grossman. That's his manager's wife, Sally Grossman.
So what was her name?
Sally Grossman, wasn't it? Yeah.
Okay. Another Bob Dylan record, one of his most curious album covers, of course, John Wesley Harding, which has the kind of the least art-directed photograph you can possibly imagine. It really is a snap, isn't it? Of him with the Balls of Bengal, who are these the musicians from Bengal who were over in Woodstock, I think. I think Albert Grossman was kind of managing them or looking after them. But who was this guy at in the back here?
He was a handyman, wasn't he? He was a carpenter or something, wasn't he? A carpenter or a plumber?
He'd come to fix the fence, apparently.
That's right.
Albert Grossman's property. And ended up becoming immortal as a consequence.
But when that record came out, I have to say, I actually, I don't know how old I was, I don't know, 16 or something like that. Much younger. I actually thought that must be the people on it. I thought that must be Charlie McCoy and Kenny Buttrey and somebody else. I don't know, maybe the producer or something. I had absolutely no idea who those people, because it doesn't tell you.
Charlie McCoy.
Charlie McCoy and Kenny Buttrey. Could they really look like that? There was no explanation for it at all. Astonishing.
I've also got, probably from the same year, Fairport Convention, Unhalf Bricking, which is a beautiful, beautiful cover, which people may know. And it's taken in Wimbledon, I think. And it's taken outside the home of Sandy Denny with the band in the background having tea on the lawn and posing at the gate as kind of proud parents and proprietors, Sandy Denny's mum and dad. And it's a lovely picture, isn't it?
It's a fantastic picture. It's fantastic. But again, did that explain on the cover who they were? Because I don't think it did.
Not at all.
So you had no idea, because, I mean, in a way, at that time, to even acknowledge that you had parents was an embarrassment.
That you weren't raised
rock,
by
rock wolf. Musicians, pop musicians, folk musicians, all of them were born in the back of a, back of a minibus traveling up the M1. They're born in it. What's this one?
Strange one. It's Dexy's Been a Runners, searching for the young soul rebels, where they had a picture. This has been a picture that had been taken years earlier of a Catholic family being forced to relocate in Belfast. At the beginning, in probably 1971 or something like that, when people were getting
They were threatened with internment.
So that's right.
Yeah.
And it's just this child looking, kind of fraught and but strangely charismatic, and with his
picture.
Possessions under his arm.
Yeah, it was called Anthony O'Shaughnessy.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And this one, The Cure, Standing on a Beach, the singles, with a gentleman looking at the camera. It looks like a lesser known poet, doesn't it? Really,
he does.
It's kind of. He's somebody who wasn't quite as famous as Seamus Heaney or something, but he's of that generation. He was apparently just a resident.
From Central Casting.
Yeah. He was just a local resident, apparently, on the beach wherever they took that picture. And they just said, would you like to be on an album cover? Oh, yeah, all right, fine. And of course, the strangest one.
He gave a very sweet little interview, that guy. I can remember saying he gave a little interview saying, I just did to help out. We've got to try and encourage the young people to make their music, and if it helps publicise. And I thought it was really, really sweet. I know.
And of course, I've got was this the first U2 album? Boy?
Oh, Boy. That's right.
A very beautiful boy on the cover. Who was the boy?
It's called Peter Rowan. Was that the guy? Peter Rowan is now a photographer, I think. And he was on the back of the War album too.
Was it the same child?
Yeah, same child.
Yeah, it probably was, wasn't it? Probably was.
Yeah, he's the brother of Googie, of the Virgin Prunes.
Oh, right.
He was a great mate of Bono's.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by how all that stuff pops up on album covers, and I'm fascinated by
what about the UFO album you were talking about the other day? Have you got that one?
No, I haven't got that, but UFOs, you may know UFO's album Force It. It's a rather agonizing pun.
Yeah.
Where there's a couple having standing, perpendicular sexual congress in a shower, aren't they? And I only recently discovered...
It's a terrible pun on the word Force It, which is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, talk about album covers that nobody would do today. Ooh, that's pride of place. Yeah. And but the two people are Genesis P. Orridge and what do you call it? Cozy Fanny Tutti.
That's right.
Because they were kind of mates of Peter Christopherson, who was one of the partners in Hypnosis at the time. And so that was just one of the ways that they...
Always Nearby.
Oh, the Incredible String Band.
Hangman's Beautiful Daughter. What a fantastic picture that is. Taken on Christmas Day, 1967. And that's Robin Williamson and Mike Heron. And two mates who I think were called Roger Marshall and Nicky Walton. And they're at the house of a girl called Mary Stewart, who's a friend of theirs, who had a little house in the mountain area, where they used to go and go hill climbing. In fact, that's where they met Rose Simpson, I think. And that's seven of her children in the picture. Isn't that amazing?
Seven of her children, wow.
Seven, no, it was five of the others. Sorry, five of them.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's pretty fantastic.
It's a beautiful picture. And of course, it wasn't... Was it on the original British cover? The original British... Was it? I don't think...
Yeah, it's on the back. That's the front. But now they've switched it, because that's the picture everybody really loves.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's a fantastic image. It's a wonderful image. And no doubt accomplished without stylists or Winnebagoes or airbrushes.
Yeah, they weren't kind of trestle tables. Just weighed down with, Waldorf salad.
Yes. Can you be weighed down with a Waldorf salad? You wanted to say something about Sting and his torment.
Oh, yeah, Sting. Well, I mean, it was just interesting. He posted this really sweet thing about his roadie, Billy Francis. Did you read it? I don't know if you read that. Did I send it to you?
I did,
Yeah, and this guy he'd been working with for 40 years who died. It was really touching. He said, Billy said, we've been friends now for over four decades. And I may have spent more time with you than I've spent with my wife and kids. Literally thousands upon thousands of gigs, trekking from city to city, country to country, and enough long-haul flights across the planet to reach the moon and back. This is the guy that got onto the stage on time, every time. They were never late. Never. He's very proud of this. They did their two-hour show, totally looked after him. He said, without him, it would have been impossible. It's been our life for over 40 years. He said, we were like a straggling line of ducks chasing their mother. And that was really touching, and it made me think that the music industry must be full of those little invisible relationships that you don't know much about. When I went on the road with U2, they had a guy who was the sound technician for The Edge called Dallas Hsu, who'd been with them about 31 years. Same thing. He was completely responsible for that incredible Edge orchestral sound of his guitar, And Neil Brockbank, the producer and sound man for Nick Lowe, and he and Neil and Nick went all over the world together, just the two of them putting on these little shows, became absolutely inseparable pals.
There's an extraordinary close relationship. We've really got no idea of it. Well, Bruce Springsteen, the guy Terry McGovern, who died a few years back for 30 years or whatever, was the guy who was always just like 2 feet away from Bruce Springsteen, everywhere but on stage, kind of thing, And because these guys never write books. These guys know absolutely everything there is to know, you know. And so there's a hugely...
Not true of Richard Cole of Led Zeppelin, actually.
Oh, right, he did. He wrote a book, but then went back, didn't he?
Well, he didn't write the book, but I mean, the entire book was based, The Hammer of the Gods was entirely based on his testament, wasn't it? And then went back and worked for them again.
Yeah.
Incredible.
But mostly they don't write books, you know. And it's really interesting about Sting's man, you know, because, you know, within a kind of bunch of musicians, there is only one person who is really organized, and it's the tour manager. And massively well organized. They have to be, because nobody else is at all.
Nobody else is.
And I remember standing in the lobby of a hotel years ago with Level 42 was staying there. And Paul Crockford was there. Paul Crockford is a very experienced manager of all kinds of bands. And he looked at me when waiting in the lobby for the band. He says, "What is it about the ability to play a musical instrument that makes people incapable
of being in a lobby?
Of being in a lobby at an appointed time. Just simply can't do it."
But also, Jane, all musicians have built into them this kind of idea that to turn up on time is somehow kind of, you know, says the wrong thing about you.
Yes.
You care too much. You know, efficiency is not the right brand value for the person who's got to be, is actually the musician on stage.
No, true. But it was very, very touching, memoir. And, you know, those relationships are very, very strong, you know, and of course they last far longer than anybody thinks they're going to last at the time they start. You know, they think, I'll do one tour or whatever, carry on forever.
And they say they spend more time with those people than they do with their own families. And it's true.
I'm sure. A bit like you and me.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.